From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. Many people tend to resist data that explicitly contradicts what they believe, and in an attempt to overcome uncomfortable cognitive dissonance, even doctors will occasionally try to explain away or justify new data. When strong beliefs, sometimes century-long beliefs, are disputed, people tend to double down. And this is true for many people, from cult members to respected researchers, but it's notably present in medicine and in the way that we tend to groupthink. In his new book, Blind Spots, When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health, Dr. Marty McCary examines how some of our most established medical practices throughout recent decades are medical dogma, and they're given absolute authority despite being relatively unfounded and have the potential to be dangerous. McCary is a surgeon, a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and a member of the National Academy of Medicine. Dr. McCary, welcome.
Great to be with you, Reagan. Thanks for having me.
Throughout this book, you take the role of a physician journalist, and this is true for two of your other books too, Unaccountable and The Price We Pay. But you note that a lot of the insight you gained were things that you felt surprised you didn't learn in medical school. I'm curious, at what point did you decide to take a step back as a physician to translate this information into plain English?
Well, I'm a pancreatic surgeon by training, and pancreatic cancer rates have doubled in the last 20 years, and nobody has been asking why. And at the same time, we're seeing all these chronic diseases in society go way up. Childhood obesity now affects half of our nation's children. Type 2 diabetes that a pediatrician might see once in their career. Now, a generation later, one in three kids will go on to have type 2 diabetes. We're seeing so many of these chronic diseases go up. Sperm counts are down 50%. Autism goes up 14% every year for the last 23 years. It has skyrocketed. Autoimmune diseases are going way up, now affect one in five women. Somebody has got to say, what is the root cause of this stuff? We can't just medicate and operate at the back end. We've got a giant healthcare economy, $4.5 trillion, and it's growing rapidly. And it's burdening everybody through their paycheck deduction for healthcare. We've got to start talking about the root causes. And it turns out there's a lot of good research on what the root causes are, but people don't know about it. The medical establishment doesn't talk about it because these ideas live in the blind spots of modern medicine.
One of these blind spots revolves around peanut allergies. You opened the book up with a pretty jarring story, the wave of children in the 90s who died of peanut allergies. And the thought was that peanuts needed to be banned in order to protect the children, but this in turn was partially responsible for igniting the epidemic of peanut allergies.
Yeah, we have the worst peanut allergy epidemic in the world. What's happened was that the modern day peanut allergy epidemic was ignited by a medical dogma in the year 2000. From the medical establishment, the American Academy of Pediatrics instructed sternly women to avoid all peanut butter and peanut-related products for children ages 0 through 3, thinking that that would reduce a child's risk of later developing a peanut allergy. But they forgot about immune tolerance, the old dirt theory, the basic principle that when you're exposed to things early, you're more likely to tolerate them later in life. And if you're not exposed to an allergen early in life, your immune system becomes sensitive. And so after this recommendation, we saw a surge in severe peanut allergies. They went from being rare and mild to common, and many were life-threatening. And for 15 years, it just increased and increased with this medical dogma that young kids should avoid peanuts. It was a perpetual cycle. And the medical establishment, rather than recognizing that they gave wrong advice, that there was never any scientific support for their recommendation, they didn't apologize or reevaluate. They doubled down. They figured there were anti-science parents out there who need to comply. And if we can only get everyone to comply with this, with their recommendation, then we could beat the epidemic. Well, of course, they had it perfectly backwards. And just 8 years ago, a study came out proving that they were very wrong and that finally reversed the official recommendation. But people need to know the truth because we still live with remnants of this old dogma. And groupthink is a powerful force.
I want to talk about some of this groupthink, this cognitive dissonance. There are a lot of benefits to being open to new ideas. You mentioned you're typically better in relationships, and just overall more open to discovering the truth. But we as humans have had a very hard time doing this. Historically, I think most people can relate in their personal lives. Why is that?
In the book Blind Spots, I do a deep dive into why we see this intense groupthink, the herd mentality, the reluctance to change a view, the resistance to new ideas that seems to be universal. It's almost like it's part of the human condition. And this was best described by a famous psychologist, Dr. Leon Festinger. And he described it perfectly. He said that we tend to believe what we hear first, not because it's more logical or more scientific, but simply because we heard it first. What's happening subconsciously is that a new idea becomes settled in the brain. It becomes nested and lazy, and it doesn't want to leave. We don't want conflict. The brain subconsciously will reject new information to avoid any discomfort. He said you have to recognize this natural lazy tendency that's subconscious to just hold on to what we believe first, because the new information we get, we will often reframe it to make it fit what we already believe. Let's say you smoke and you hear that there's a study showing smoking is bad for you. You'll find a way subconsciously to go to do acrobatics to show that, oh, well, the new study was done in different people. Or I do other things that make me healthy so it counterbalances so the study doesn't apply to me. Or I use filtered cigarettes. They probably didn't use the filtered cigarettes in the study. The brain will subconsciously go through all kinds of acrobatics to basically hold on to what we believe first. And Dr. Festinger said we have to recognize that and recognize what's going on and suspend our biases in order to be impeccably objective.
As you mentioned, I think a lot of people shy away from this idea of I don't know. We like to have an answer for everything, even if it's based on only pieces of information. But you note that I don't know is important because it leads to important questions. And I want to talk about some of these questions that you were led to ask. I think one of the ones that I was the most enthralled by was antibiotic prescriptions. I think many of us have been written antibiotic prescriptions based on a quick Teladoc appointment. If I have a cold longer than usual, I almost always assume it's a sinus infection because of the frequency that I've been prescribed antibiotics. And this is something that you're warning people about in your book.
Yes, and it's not just me. The guy who discovered antibiotics, Alexander Fleming, quickly issued a stern warning that people have forgotten, and that was, we have to avoid unnecessary use of antibiotics. He warned of unintended consequences and even undoing the effects of antibiotics because of resistance that the bacteria would develop. So here, the most amazing discovery of modern medicine is at risk right now of being lost. We're seeing more and more resistant bacteria. But separate from the issue of overuse of antibiotics in humans and agriculture, by the way, there's another more personal individual risk. And that is, antibiotics are altering the microbiome, the lining of the gastrointestinal tract of millions of different bacteria that are really part of a central organ system that we are increasingly recognized. Basically, these bacteria are involved in digestion, training the immune system that is closely adjacent to these bacteria in the gut. They produce serotonin, involved in mood and mental health. And a new study found that when kids take antibiotics in the first couple of years of life compared to kids who don't, they have a higher rate of obesity, a 20% higher rate of obesity, higher rates of learning disabilities, including a 32% higher rate of attention deficit disorder. And they're far more likely to develop asthma or celiac disease. And the more antibiotic courses a child took, the higher the risk of each of these, what we call a dose-dependent relationship. And farmers have noticed this for a long time. When you give antibiotics to animals, they're fatter. And so the world expert on the microbiome said, if this is happening to animals, what's it doing to our nation's children? And sure enough, these same phenomena are happening. We're seeing a parallel. People need to know about the importance of gut health.
And your gut microbiome is so interconnected with everything, with your mental health. There's so many ties between everything that we do, everything that we feel, sicknesses, diseases. So to have this very blatant danger to our gut microbiome is very, very scary.
It is so central to health. The microbiome is central to so many of the conditions in modern medicine that we say we don't understand. But remember, when you change that composition of bacteria in the microbiome from the modern world, the body is reacting with inflammation, especially when you take food ingredients that are basically chemicals that do not appear in nature. It's not a massive response. It's a low-grade response at the level of the gut. And that inflammation makes people feel sick. They just feel blah. They feel low energy. It affects them. And the inflammation affects the entire body. And guess what? Almost every major condition is either caused by inflammation or hastened by it. Heart disease is inflammation of the coronary artery wall, inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, rheumatic conditions. So inflammation is really the central part of health that's lived in the blind spots of modern medicine, along with the microbiome.
You mentioned heart disease. I think that we all know that one of the main ways to prevent that is to avoid cholesterol. Or we think we know that, especially as you get older, you avoid cholesterol. And this recommendation is devastating to some people. Tell me about your Uncle Sam.
Well, Uncle Sam loved to eat eggs when he lived in Egypt. And when he came to the United States in his 30s, his American doctor that he assumed was the, you know, best doctor in the world, told him, "You've got to stop eating eggs." And for the next several years, the doctor gave him a guilt trip and made him feel like he was going to die early, and this was the worst thing he could do, and he needed to, otherwise he was healthy, but this is the thing he had to stop. And it was this very tense thing, and a negotiation took place, and finally my uncle just go cold turkey and stop eating eggs for 30 years, something he loved. Well, then his son, who became a doctor, said, "Hey, Papa, there's no evidence that eating eggs is bad for you. And the low-fat diet has been debunked, and most people to this day still don't know it." So Uncle Sam went back to eating eggs, and now he's 92 years old, and he is eating eggs every morning after he gets back from his morning swim in South Florida, and he looks and feels great.
And this means that the medical industry may have gotten the primary cause of heart disease wrong for nearly 60 years.
And they still get it wrong. It's unbelievable. It is still backwards. I was at a health benefits fair and I met a dietitian there and I said, "What's your booth about?" And she said, "Well, part of your health benefits, part of your insurance at the university here is you get free nutrition consults." And I said, "Okay, just out of curiosity, let's say I come in 20 pounds overweight. What do you recommend?" And the first thing she went to was try to avoid fat. It is unbelievable. Three major studies have been done to try to prove the fat heart disease association. All three failed to show them. Avoiding dietary cholesterol is one of the most ironic things in modern society because the cholesterol we eat is not even absorbed by your body. Every cell in your body has cholesterol, and 99% of it is made by your body. It's not from dietary cholesterol. So the great irony is trying to avoid cholesterol and tiptoe around it is really just part of the misinformation of a big area that's lived in the blind spots of modern medicine as the food pyramid written by the food industry dominated. And the low-fat recommendation came from one doctor 60, 70 years ago, Ansel Keys, who was really a politician, misled people with his research study, but he was so slick, he convinced the American Heart Association and the Surgeon General and the government to all get behind his low-fat recommendation. Tragically, that moved the food supply to a high refined carbohydrate food supply in the United States. And now we know the refined carbohydrates and added sugar are driving inflammation, which is part of the predisposing factor to obesity. And as we shifted the food supply from normal food to low-fat, refined carbohydrate foods, guess what? Obesity rates soared in total parallel with this dogma.
And the food industry in the United States, it's something we've spoken about on the show before, and it's frightening how quickly the composition of our food has changed. And it's also frightening, I think, how intertwined the medical industry is with the food industry and how some of those ideas are being perpetuated.
Well, Reagan, you're reminding me of recently I was asked to give the keynote speech for the big nutrition dietetics meeting in the United States. This is the meeting that all the dietitians go to. It is the central annual meeting. And of course, I like to push the field, and I challenged in my speech the notion that should we be really recommending 3 glasses of cow's milk for every American every day? This is one of the old medical dogmas. And afterwards, this nice lady came up and talked to me, and I noticed her name tag said American Milk Association. And she, you know, took issue with what I said. And I find out they are one of the 2 big sponsors of the conference. The other big sponsor, I found out later, Coca-Cola. So these food pyramid nutrition recommendations, the government's food nutrition guidelines, which comes from experts, 90%+ who are conflicted with the food industry. This is not medical science. And we've got to address our poison food supply. We've got all these chronic diseases going up. We've got to talk about these root causes.
And a lot of this is also intertwined in politics.
Yeah, you know, the politicians will give us these shiny objects, like their healthcare policy is that they're going to get Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Well, fine, good. But the savings is $6 billion in a $4.7 trillion healthcare economy that's expanding by $200 billion a year. These are things around the periphery. Don't be fooled by these shiny objects. These are things around the edges. They are not the central solutions to fixing our healthcare system. We have got to stop talking about just financing our broken healthcare system. We have to talk about how to fix it. We have to talk about the root causes, our poison food supply, highly engineered addictive chemicals we add to the food supply that are banned in other countries, pesticides, environmental exposures, toxins, bad advice from the government's nutrition council, and the role of ultra-processed foods. We've got to talk about health. So don't be fooled by these distractions or decoys. They may have merits in and of themselves, these different issues like Medicare, negotiating drug prices, but we have got to start talking about health.
Another one of your largest discourses throughout the book is surrounding hormone replacement therapy in postmenopausal women. And this one was nightmarish to me.
Oh my gosh. The role of hormone replacement for women who go through menopause is a miracle. I mean, it is unbelievable. The vast majority of women who go through menopause are candidates. They need to start it within 10 years of menopause. And if they do, it not only alleviates the short-term symptoms of menopause, which can be nightmarish, the hot flashes, weight gain, mood swings, night sweats. Not only can it alleviate these symptoms, but it has long-term health benefits because the estrogen oxidizes and increases nitric oxide, which keeps the blood vessel wall soft and healthy and dilated. A woman on average taking hormone therapy starting around the time of menopause lives 3.5 years longer. The rate of heart attacks is cut in half. That's the number one cause of death in women. The rate of cognitive decline goes way down by 50 to 60%. It reduces the risk of Alzheimer's by 35%. And if a woman falls, they have stronger bones because of the estrogen. They're far less likely to break a bone or have a hip fracture later in life. The benefits are overwhelming, but tragically, 80% of doctors today will not prescribe it because of a dogma from an announcement 22 years ago that hormone therapy causes breast cancer.
And there was bullying of other researchers to back this announcement up, right?
There was a backroom meeting just before the announcement where a bunch of his own doctors said, you can't put this out there. There's no statistically significant increased risk of breast cancer. And if you dangle fear in front of women with an issue as sensitive as breast cancer, you will never be able to undo this. You will never be able to put the genie back in the bottle. And those words were prophetic.
Why was this done? What was the benefit of making this proclamation?
I think it comes back to the cognitive dissonance that we just talked about, the reluctance to be open to new ideas. This doctor who made the announcement had gone on record, I found out, saying publicly that we have to stop the hormone therapy bandwagon in postmenopausal women. I mean, he had seemed to have already made up his mind before the study even had its results available. But that's not how we do science. This kind of very hubris approach, the arrogance, the dogma, has done a lot of damage. 50 million women have been denied the incredible health benefits of hormone replacement therapy. Maybe the medication second to antibiotics that has improved or could improve the health of a population more than any other medication.
And this dogma is prevalent everywhere. Tell me about some of the medical dogma surrounding the delivery of babies, because it's there in a couple of different ways.
There are best practices that are still not broadly used. For example, a baby that is born should have the umbilical cord intact and continue to pulsate blood for the few minutes that it normally does pulsate after the baby is born. The baby is getting a flow of stem cells and fetal hemoglobin, which has a high, tight oxygen binding. It's good hemoglobin, and antibodies and nutrients, and most importantly, warm blood. The warm blood is going directly into their circulatory system, which keeps the baby warm. Instead, we cut the cord immediately, whisk the baby off. And when I would ask, hey, where are we going? Where are we taking the baby? They would say, we have to rewarm the baby. Well, we just cut the umbilical cord. We don't need to put the baby under a French fry light of some kind to rewarm the baby. And the mom should hold the baby after being born. There's studies now showing the benefits of delayed cord clamping. The brain myelination, that is the patterns of nerves in the brain, are different in babies where there's delayed cord clamping. And there's something magical about the bonding of a mother and baby at birth that we've not fully captured in medicine. We do know when the mom holds the baby that the baby's heart rate and blood pressure are more normal. The glucose level of the baby is more normal when the mom holds the baby. The baby's stress hormones are not spiking, and we know high stress hormones change the baby's glucose level. So there's something powerful there. People need to know about these best practices because many women can now create a birth plan with their doctor or health professional and ask for these things. We need people to be educated about these issues so they can be partners in their own care and birth plan.
And that's why asking these questions and having a basis of truth to go off of is so important.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to put over 400 scientific studies in the references of the book so people can do a deeper dive. There's so much dogma out there. And we don't want to create cynicism towards doctors. I love being a doctor and I need my patients to trust me. And if you have an emergency, do whatever the doctor says. But when it comes to things where you can have a discussion, think about options and alternatives, it's good to be educated and it's good to partner with your physician.
On the subject of cynicism, a lot of this is a little frightening, I think. And we have the urge to trust medical professionals wholeheartedly and to rely on them to keep us safe and to keep us well. And so I think having these questions and being willing to ask questions can be a little daunting. How do you maintain hope and trust when you're seeing so many longstanding ideas disproved and some new research swept aside?
Well, I think what makes a good doctor is the doctor's humility, their willingness to say, I don't know, or I haven't heard of that alternative before, but I'm happy to look at it or study it or ask a colleague who may know more about it. We should be having a relationship with our patients as doctors. And let's be honest, we've had our blind spots in modern medicine. That's why I wrote this book. Maybe we should be treating more diabetes with cooking classes instead of just throwing insulin at people. Maybe we should talk more about sleep quality when we see a patient with high blood pressure, instead of just giving them antihypertensive medications. Maybe we need to talk about school lunch programs, not just putting every six-year-old who's overweight on Ozempic. Maybe we need to talk about the environmental exposures that cause cancer, not just the chemo to treat it. We've got to talk about food as medicine and body inflammation and gut health and the microbiome. These issues have lived in the blind spots of modern medicine. So a conversation with a health professional on these topics is not just something one should do. It's central to health for so many things that are non-emergent and non-urgent.
That's Dr. Marty McCary. He is a surgeon, a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and a member of the National Academy of Medicine. He's the author of two New York Times bestsellers, and his most recent book is Blind Spots: When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health. Dr. McCary, thank you so much.
So good to be with you, Reagan. Thanks.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our executive producer is Matthew LaPlante. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and I'm Reagan Edelman. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.